listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Wow, it's so nice to see so many of you here this morning. I think many of you were here for the new member entering ceremony that we just did. And my name's Linda. Is there anyone here for the first time? Wonderful. Welcome. And I'm so filled with joy from just doing this new member welcoming ceremony, because it's a ceremony of acknowledgement, recognition, gratitude, appreciation, and, you know, as so many Zen things are, the celebration has a soft, quiet quality to it, but also suffused with joy. And thank you to all the members who have joined recently and are now having this formal ceremony to acknowledge them. You know, and when we have meals, we talk about, there's a phrase, giver, receiver, and gift. And it's this this cycle of three, that there's a giver, there's a receiver, and then there has to be a gift in there, but they're actually inseparable. And so the cycle of generosity is empty, in the sense that there is no thing to grasp onto, but it comes alive in manifesting it, in enacting it. They're inseparable. So to become more involved in Berkeley Zen Center is to open yourself to the whole interplay of giver, receiver, and gift. When I first came to Berkeley Zen Center in the mid-90s, January of 90s, oh wow, 30 years in a matter of weeks. When I first walked through the gate, I felt welcomed in a really nice way. I'd come late because I refused to believe what was posted on the flyer. It could not be that early. Monday morning was when they had the special thing that started at 5:40 rather than, so I showed this a little later. Fortunately, it happened to be at the clunk. So there was somebody outside who just very gently, with hand signals, waved me here and there and let me know that I was welcome, which was really powerful for me in this very quiet way. I felt seen. I'd meditated before, quite a bit, but I hadn't done Zen. I didn't know any
forms. And it just felt really good to be here, to be in the sendo, to feel the strength of the practice, which was really palpable when I entered the sendo. And then, and everybody left quietly afterwards, but Dolly Gattozzi, who was there then, she saw that I was coming every day. It really worked. I was very fortunate to be on my work was on one end of a line. That was my house, the Zendo, and where I was working. So I just came every day because work was at 8. And she noticed that I was coming. So she asked me my name, and then every morning she would say, "Good morning, Linda," and wish me a good day. So those moments of feeling seen and appreciated were really, really wonderful. I think I would have also been fine, and many people are, to just come very quietly, not have any interactions, and just have the feeling in the Zendo. But for me, the two together were really important, specifically because I already had a sitting practice, a strong sitting practice, and I was doing a lot of Vipassana retreats. I think in the year before that, I had managed to spend 5 weeks doing that. But there wasn't a Sangha in the East Bay for Vipassana. There was one night a week group, but it was kind of far, and then there was Spirit Rock, and it was huge, and I knew I needed Sangha practice. that it wasn't just about sitting. It was something about practicing together with other people in Sangha and all the things that come along with that. And I had no idea what all went along with that. It was just, it was a calling at that point in my practice, as much as earlier I'd been called to practice. There was a resonance, you know, and it's like, And it was very interesting. I had apparently been interested in finding a place to sit or a place to sit Zen 2 or 3 years before I came, because about a few months after I started practicing, I found, we used to only have mailers before the internet, you know, like a little mailer trifold. It was very nice. And I found that I already had one, and it was dated like 2 or 3 years ago. I'm like, wow, what happened to that? Wasn't the right time. And then it was. So as I said, I started and just kept going, not knowing what it would lead to. So you never know. Yeah. So a few months after I had joined, I was standing at the bulletin board looking at things, and I think it was after Soji in the morning, and it was a Saturday, and I remember it so clearly, it's amazing. And Ross came over, and he stood next to me, and he said, "I see that you've been coming a lot lately, and that's really great. And it seems like you're getting something out of the practice." I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "Have you ever thought about becoming a member?" I'm like, "No." And I was really kind of embarrassed, because it hadn't occurred to me to do that. I wasn't a joiner. I didn't kind of do that. And I realized that, you know, my experience of just coming, and I was only coming in the mornings, not even on Saturdays. I had a yoga class on Saturday mornings, which at that time was the priority. But so I was only coming in the mornings, and I didn't see all that went into making Berkeley Zen Center happen in all the ways that we're used to. You know, if I'd come for Saturdays, I knew we did Soji together, but I didn't see any more than that. But what I got was that, you know, I was needed in some way to make this all happen. You know, I appreciated that Ross had brought that up with me, because I recognized that this is something that a lot of people create together. They're all doing things. There are buildings. There's, you know, forms and ceremonies. And I've been just receiving. And I realized that I could participate. I could belong rather than just coming. And I hadn't done something like that before in my life. So that was fresh. And the next thing that, the next kind of marker in my practice, it was not long after that, I sat my first one-day sesshin, one-day Zen sesshin. And I was assigned the role of bell ringer, which means that you get up and play that bell, rather than one of these bells, to mark the beginning and end of each period, and lead kinhin, lead the walking meditation during the periods between zazen. And that was a completely different experience than just coming in and sitting down and following along, because I had to watch the clock. I had a form. You know, it was like clear instructions. It wasn't like it was a hard thing to do, but it meant that I felt responsible all day long. And I was really honored and surprised that they would entrust me with a role like this. And it was also hard. It was not an easy thing. And it stretched me. And boy, did I get to see my mind. You know, I'm not even getting a break. How do I take a how do I go to the bathroom, you know? I'm leading all this time. And in the moment, it was not my best one-day sit. It was fine, but it was a little tense, you know? But I've had a lot of difficult sittings, so, you know, but the thing was, it really got me in the door, and especially, it wasn't just that I was left alone. Periodically, someone would come check in, you know, because they knew I was new to this, and find out how it was going, and just, do you need anything? I mean, it was simple. It was like, you okay? Yes. And I was okay. And I stretched. So you never know what you're going to get when you just say yes. But a lot of the time, even if that moment is hard or challenging or presents you with something new that you weren't expecting, I mean, it always does, right? You say yes to something when you don't know exactly what it, you think you know what it is, but it's always different. But that capacity to trust that you can grow into something, trust that you'll be supported, trust that it's okay. Whether it's cooking for the Sangha or serving or cleaning the toilets, you know, it's all forms of support and it's all necessary. So, you know, to practice Zen is to practice with others. Used to have a Sangha member here many years ago, very, very dedicated, very devoted, and now one of the foremost, still a priest, and one of the foremost translators of Japanese Zen today. And at the time, he was much younger then. He said, you know, if you're not sitting with other people, it's not Zazen. You know, it's like, this is what we do. This is our practice. And I wouldn't go that far, but I would say that it's a whole realm of practice that is different in some ways than sitting by yourself at home. Because you're rubbing up against people. Even if it's just rubbing up against them because they're breathing in a way that you would rather be otherwise. Or they moved, or whatever it is, you know? And I personally really value both forms of practice. I started off in Vipassana. I first resonated with Zen, reading it, but then I couldn't find a place to practice. So I started sitting in Vipassana, and it was wonderful. I loved it. And I still love it. I still go on Vipassana retreats when I can because it's just dropping off everything. It doesn't have all these opportunities, but it has a lot of space. But I knew that it was really important to also bridge between sitting on the cushion and the world and relationship and people. So, you know, like any relationship, your relationship with practice, your relationship with this Zendo, with Berkeley Zen Center, with the Sangha and individual Sangha members, it's a commitment, it's a relationship. So it has like every possible flavor of relationships, not necessarily on one person, but like everything comes up. And because, you know, we come together regularly and over time, and I think critically, because whether formally or less formally, we're all here for like the same core reasons, which is to wake up and find a way to live, and then we, you know, in harmony with each other and with ourselves and with the world. And then we get some language and some forms that help us express that, like the Bodhisattva vows, you know, beings are numberless. I vow to awaken with them. And the precepts and the refuges and all these different aspects. So this gives us a container in which to practice and a container in which to learn all the ways that we belong and all the ways that we can support it, which changes over time. Sometimes, very often over time, the ways that we can be involved or give and receive or express support deepen over time, and then there's also times in our lives when it's not that way, when we can't for a period of time. When I was coming earlier, I knew a number of people who were here, and they were just really regular, and then they started a family, and then we saw them again 18 years later, basically. But their practice extended into their family life. Having that grounding in practice, they took it into raising a family. So it's love, you know. Sangha is a manifestation of love, and it includes all of it. But fundamentally, it's that connection and willingness to show up. I think that's really love. And the foundation of trust is to show up with your best self and listen and express. That's this moment. We'll see what I say another day. Some variation of that, I think, though. So, another manifestation of love, of course, is generosity. And the Buddha, out of love for the world, out of compassion for the world, chose, after his awakening, to re-enter the suffering world and do his best to share what he had awakened to. So that's an act of generosity, an act of love. And in the paramitas, the perfections, Dana Paramita, the perfection of generosity, is the first. And I love that Dogen also says, you can give the flowers on a distant hillside. So it's not just tangible things. I'm remembering the Christmas carol I loved when I was a little kid, you know, the little drummer boy, pa-rum-pa-pum-pum, you know, and he came to visit the baby Jesus and he said, I have nothing for you, except I can play on my drum. And that, of course, was held up as the greatest gift because it was from the heart. So we can give from the heart, we can give of our bodies in doing things that need to be taken care of. So many of you here do all of these things all the time. And we can contribute to the material support of the temple. All of these things are make the temple possible. It doesn't just happen. Anyone here who's taken on responsible positions within the Sangha knows it doesn't just happen. Although everybody's really good about making it look like it's nothing. It's nothing. Because it's been a little at a time, little at a time, stretching into it. So it's like, oh yeah, here's this. This is what it's like to serve. This is what it's like to make a mistake, recover, and go on. I think one of the things that I'd always kind of wanted to experience was to be a working part of a whole. I didn't have words for it. I didn't have more than a kind of a felt sense. But it wasn't, I wanted something that was beyond just a friendship. I wanted something where we were doing things together. That it was embodied. I think many people have, I never had it in team sports. I think a lot of people have had it in team sports or group hikes or things like that, that there's this together thing, but I just didn't happen to have those things. So it was easy for me to feel like a working part of the whole that was Berkeley Zen Center. That was great. Oh, I want to say a little bit about Sangha. The Sangha is the community. It's one of the three treasures. Three treasures are Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The Buddha, the awakened ones, are teachers. There are many meanings to this. And Dharma, the teachings, and Sangha, the community. And the meaning of the word Sangha has changed over time. It originally meant just the arhats, just the awakened ones, the fully awakened ones in the Buddha's time. And then it expanded a little farther and it included a wider circle as more people awakened in the Buddha's Sangha. And then it included all the monastics, all the nuns, you know, so it's the Sangha of all Buddhists. It also can refer to a particular community, like the Berkeley Zen Center Sangha. And I really like the way it's evolved to become, which Buddhism has also, to become more widely inclusive. The word Sangha, it's a Sanskrit word, and it literally means that which is struck well together. I think kind of like, you know, it was struck. It wasn't stuck well together. It was struck, like, you know, like clay or metals are struck well together and they become strong, stronger like that. And it refers to something solid, something not easily broken apart. And in fact, one of the five grave offenses, along with killing a Buddha, killing your father, mother, is causing schism within the Sangha. You know, causing this divisiveness. I'm still turning that one. You know. So. You know, Lori and I were talking about, you know, that I was wishing that I knew more people in the Sangha because I go through the member list or I'm writing thank you cards to people and I'm like, I don't know all these people yet. I've been here for over a year and I haven't met all of them. And she said, yeah, she looked at the list. She said, yeah, some of them have moved away and some of them are, you know, can't come in person anymore, or whatever. And so, you know, she posted something that I would really like to meet with more people and inviting people to sign up for Dokusan with me. And that's been going great. I don't get to sit much Zazen anymore, but I can, not in here. But I feel you from right over there. And I would love to continue that and also invite people who can't come in person during Zazen to just email me and we'll, you know, we'll find a time that works for you or we can do something on Zoom. So, yeah, probably given what coming into Rohatsu and the holidays, we'll do that in the new year. But I would love to meet with more and more of you. I'd love to hear about your practice and your experience of BZC and what's alive for you. And it also really helps me to just have more and more of a sense of who the Sangha is and what each of you brings and what each of you are receiving or wish that you are receiving. And this is true even if you already have a teacher. I just like being in touch with people and being able to connect a little bit. So if any of you are interested in becoming a member, where's Sue? There's Sue right over here with her hand up. She mentioned in the new member welcoming ceremony. She's the coordinator, and you can talk to her after the talk when we have tea and cookies. And if you're online, you can just go to the generosity tab on BZC, and it will be able to find membership and connect with Sue that way. So, good. I was hoping I could make it kind of short so we'd have plenty of time for questions, because I'd love to hear, you know, if you have questions, but also if you just have an experience that you'd like to share about Sangha practice or becoming a member or what it's like to take up positions here, anything that has arisen for you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your wonderful talk. I remember one time in Tassajara, a student there who had been studying Sanskrit told me that his best definition for Sangha was something that's nailed down in place. It's funny because you and I were traveling around a lot. We were going from place to place. And experiencing life in different sanghas. And then we came back here to where it all began for both of us, actually, same time, January 96. And it has been something I've been turning a lot. Now, you know, now I really feel nailed down in place. My gosh. But how do you, you know, there's also a more expansive feeling of Sangha. Like there's more expansive feeling of family. You know, I have a refrigerator magnet that says we're all cousins. and so how do you see including that?
Thank you. Well, you may not, some of you probably know, but you, not all of you probably know that there's a number of what we call branching streams sanghas, which are the, you know, the branching streams that all come from the one source, who was Suzuki Roshi. So these are all Suzuki Roshi lineage. There are like 80 of them, and they're all around the world, mostly in this country, mostly on the West Coast, but they're all over. And it's we have conferences. Colleen and Greg and I got to go to the Branching Streams Conference earlier this year, where a number of people come together, and you can see where do morning service, where it's a little different. Every service is like, whoa, you do it like that. Okay, great, that's cool. But just to learn about each other. But it's like meeting your cousins, you know, that you don't even know yet, because we share this lineage. We share so much, and then there are the details. There are the family details, you know, of each, you know, each set of cousins, and you know, like that. Do you have anything you want to add to that? Since we've both been traveling.
No. Just it feels good to be. It feels very good to be nailed down in place back where it started.
Shore.
Thank you for your talk, Linda. I'm wondering if you could talk more about, you mentioned just a sentence about making a mistake while doing a roll or something around the temple. I was curious if you would talk more about that. It made me think about how I think coming to practice, or I think I've realized that for me, the fear of making a mistake is actually way worse and more painful than making the mistake. And so I was just curious if that resonates with you at all. I'm really remembering the first time I was a Jisha, and I really didn't know what I was doing. And that's a very public role, to not know what you're doing. And I made it through the day, and it was fine. I didn't know what I was doing. And frankly, I still don't really know what the Jisha does at all. people are always asking me. I'm like, oh, and I have a thought, like a piece of paper that tells me, but I just really don't know. Anyway, I think I see a mistake. It's like, oh, you can actually be really skillful at making mistakes. And once I realized that it was just another thing to learn how to do, it wouldn't trip me up so much when I found myself in the midst of one. And I'm just curious if you have anything else to add or...
No, that all of what you said resonates so much with my own experience. I thought it was the single greatest gift of being on the Doan Ryo at Tassajara for a practice period, because I would kind of freeze when I made a mistake, which makes subsequent mistakes like so, like you just, like you're not quite there. So and it was just like, okay, it's like they're happening every day. Not dying, not dying, not dying yet. Nobody's dying yet. Nobody talked to me. Nobody gave a funny look. And then my story, I don't know where and when I tell my stories. You may have heard this one also. But just before I was ordained, I was at Tassajara. It was during the spring work period. There were various visitors there. And there was someone on the ton opposite me who, after the robe chant, got up, and she looked like she was trying not to smile, and I was wondering what was so funny, until I noticed, you know, she was wearing a brown robe, so she was a Dharma Transmit teacher. Nobody I knew, I have no idea who she was. And then I noticed that the ties, this is tied together right here, which is what keeps it on, were hanging out the bottom. She probably didn't wear okesa really often, and she'd gotten it turned around, so she put it on upside down, and she'd like kind of tucked this corner in, which wasn't gonna last very long, and she had this huge grin on her face, and I'm like, okay, I'm gonna make it. Like, if she can come and make a mistake of that magnitude and be smiling, it's like, I'm all in for this. And just this morning, you know, I read the script for the ceremony, and then all the new members are lining up, and they bow, and I'm bowing with them, thinking they're bowing to me. No, it's to the altar. I'm like, oh, okay. And I had a moment, it's like I noticed it, had a moment of embarrassment, you know, and it's like, oh. I'm like, you know, it's okay. And kind of appreciating that it could be okay. So, Sue. And then I think we have someone online. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for your talk. That I'm running around in circles with that wonderful, the gift, the giver, and the receiver. There's no separation here. Like, your mistake is your gift. I've had that experience, which has been life-changing, that it's okay. And I can't even tell you what a gift that is to be with that. And so many people I'm running into who are doing such amazing work in the world, and social justice and climate and preserving wilderness, and their gift, you know, it's just circular, the gift and the receiver and the giver are amazing, and it just feels all one now. So thank you for opening that door so I could think about that. Thank you.
If someone online.
Kabir, if you'd like to unmute.
Hello, Kabir.
Hi, Linda Roshi. So it's a comment and also a question. Comment is about, advice actually. So I am one of those parents that I had a taste of the Dharma and then busy with kids. So I'm a remote practitioner, if you call it. And it gets a little tough sometimes, but just remembering the breath and I think Sojin, she said one time something about continuous zazen or continuous meditation and every activity. And I was wondering if you heard him say that, or if you have anything to add to that. And the second question is, yes, I love it. It is okay. It's been helping me a lot lately. But one of this is not okay.
I'll start with that one. What do you mean by not okay?
So what if there's abuse involved? You know, somebody gets hurt, or what's happening, you know, and just in, you know, so when do we say no? I mean, because I know Kategori said, you know, you have to say something, like one of the books you wrote, right? When do we say it's not okay?
When it hurts someone. I think that, you know, and you could put that toward yourself too. You know,
yeah.
We do things sometimes that hurt ourselves.
Yeah.
So I think seeing clearly, not just inwardly, but outwardly. I mean, sometimes we're late in coming to the realization that are not reaching out to someone. It wasn't what we did, it was we didn't do as much. You know, the sins of commission, of doing something, and the sins of omission, the things we didn't do, can also be harmful and hurtful in varying degrees, which we can imagine, but we don't know. We also don't know what the outcome of them will be. Could be a turning word or a turning moment. But I think when we recognize, because we're looking and because we're open, that our words or our actions we feel has caused harm to others, then we do our best to apologize and make whatever amends we can. And that's also a form of connection. That's repairing something which may have been damaged or broken. And we don't know. We won't know until we do that.
Yeah.
If it has been harmed, and if we can do, you know, what may be a lot or maybe a little bit of work. And if people, so this is why the Buddha said, you need to have a certain amount of wholesome shame in order to practice.
Mm.
Not toxic shame, not being
awesome.
Mired in it. But wholesome shame, shame which lets you know it, you have a response in your body or your body-mind that something that you did was not okay. And if you lack that, and there are people who lack that, you can't really practice, because it's not just about sitting and meditating. It's about how we manifest. It's how we live.
It is similar to becoming an adult in the book, Opening the Hand of Thought.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Becoming an adult, yeah.
Yeah, thank you for your question. And you ask about, did Sojin Roshi ever say that? He went through different periods, and
yeah.
He may have been saying that in a period when I wasn't practicing so closely with him, but the heart of it, absolutely, all the time.
All the time.
Yeah.
It's on demand. It's on demand.
That's his practice. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ben.
Thank you, Linda Roshi. I came across, I was listening to an old talk of Sojin's, and he was speaking about Sangha life at Tassajara. And I won't get into the details because there was details, but he arrived at this comment that has been resonating with me, that when we're alone and our door is closed or whatever, when we're not around anyone, we think maybe that the actions we take there have no effect. It's just our action. But actually, it's affecting everyone, and we don't know it, maybe. And I can see how that's likely easier to see in monastic practice at Tassajara, but I've been sitting with, oh my God, all the things I think. Yeah, there's no... no action is... anyway, could you say something about that?
Yes, thank you for your question. So there's giver, receiver, and gift, which are inseparable, but each of us, all of us, are inseparable from the universe, from the world. Like, where, just on a very concrete level, where is my body? I eat food. This delicious tofu breakfast dish is not me. Now it's me. Now it's not me. Oxygen, same way, comes in, goes out along the way. It's pumping through blood and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, and our words and our actions, you know, it's like you wake up on the right side of the bed in the morning. You know, everything feels good and it's going well, and you get up and there's a sense of ease for whatever reason. And so this is all like stuff happening inside. And then you go out and you happen to pass someone and you're passing that on, because that's been what you've been hanging out in. Or maybe you woke up and it was a good day and then you thought, well, I'll just check the news before I go out. And then you walk out, you know, and then you contribute to someone's not so good day. You know, everything, what was it? Everything everywhere all at once. You know, that movie, and it was like, that's just the Avatamsaka Sutra, you know, with CGI. It's great, you know. But it is, it's everything. I mean, yeah. The Buddha talked about, you know, what I teach was how to awaken, you know, how to become free from suffering, particularly the suffering we cause ourselves, which is the extra. He said, and what I teach is like a handful of leaves. What I realized is a whole forest. So what you're talking about is the whole forest, you know, and you don't have to know more than the handful of leaves that you can see and take care of. But knowing that the whole forest is there, and we also know now that the forest talks to each other. They listen, they feel, they respond to the pain in each other. So talk about working part of a whole. Oh, thank you. Anyone else? Marley.
Oops. Sorry, foot is slipping a little bit. Thank you so much for your talk and all your responses. Speaking of strange threads that go beyond what we can see, I also had that very same first Sesshin job. And people may know that time management is not always my strongest point. And it was deeply stressful the entire time, and yet it was so valuable, even though that was the case. I think exactly for some of those reasons you say, which is like to learn that even when it's stressful, even when you're getting it wrong or using all your energy to not getting wrong, it's still part of what keeps the Sesshin going and still helping people even imperfectly, which is the best I could do in that moment. And I guess the other thing I'll say, since you asked for questions about membership and sangha positions and things, is you know, I've just passed on the bathroom attendant work after 2 years. And I wish you well with it. That really drew me into so much more community around here, because I had an appointment. I'm going to come to Zazen every Wednesday morning, and I would see people, and I was like, even if I don't want to, I'm going to show up so that I can clean the bathroom. And so it reached out far beyond the toilet. So thank you.
Yes, just so. I think we have time for maybe one more. Yeah, Margaret.
I would just like to extend a note of gratitude because I entered this tradition through online, not with Berkeley Zen Center, but with San Francisco Zen Center. And it was, yes, the pandemic, but also a time of my life when I was entering a new relationship and then marriage and then a new role as a parent, new jobs, new husband in grad school. Well, so the ability to have online as a doorway that's available so that I could, be a bystander with the screen off, sitting on my couch while people are also desperately hoping I can help them as well. It was very critical, especially in that period of time when there were so many demands. So now that we're kind of in this world where maybe we consider a lot of the in-person virtual world, I really want to acknowledge everyone who's tuning in remotely, and also that we maintain that doorway. Just having experienced, the ability to still connect with the teacher and to have opportunities to start and then deepen a practice has been really transformative to me. And then to suddenly, later, many years later, actually show up in person and think about an in-person Sangha and how welcoming it's been. So I just, want to acknowledge the complexity of what a doorway is and what attendance is and what it means to show up in your life in that moment, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you so much for saying that. I was really sorry we couldn't have the, due to PG&E brownout, we couldn't have the ceremony online and welcome the new members who are going to participate that way. And thanks to all of you online for being that Sangha. There are people here that I barely know who are online because that's their Sangha, but I don't sit in the Zendo online. So I don't know all of you who do that so regularly, but I found out that there are some of you who are extremely regular, which is, so I'm gonna look at you now. The camera's now up there, so I'll look at you. Yeah, that's better. Okay, you can see that I'm looking at you now. Hi. and thank you for making an online Sangha. I'm such a body person, I'm such an in-person person, and I'm older. But what you all are doing, and Blake, thank you so much for being online tech host so frequently. And it's made connection possible because otherwise, when people's lives change, they wouldn't be able to participate anymore. And now people can. So it's a beautiful thing. On that note, thank you all very much.
Beings are numberless. I vow to awaken with them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them.